Metcast, Saturday, March 20th, 2011. Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Got a great show for you today. I'm really pretty excited. Of course, a lot of information about the iPad 2. I gave my initial thoughts on the MacCast member show, I think last Friday, but you have probably been waiting in anticipation to hear my thoughts on this show. And I'm going to share those with you along with a lot of other details. I kind of wanted to get some time under my belt with the iPad to really run it through its paces. And I've had time to do that, and I'm going to talk about that today. Also, we're going to be talking about some Mac stuff, some bugs and things like that have been surfacing, a bunch of other information. And I have an interesting segment at the end talking about a little bit of Mac history, some information on the PICT file format and where that's ended up in recent versions of Mac OS X. We're going to talk to one of our listeners who's also a developer working in that realm, and it leads to a broader discussion about legacy formats and what do we do about our data as we move forward and we get new systems and machines and new software and stuff like that. So it's a lot of fun. Stay tuned. Before we dive into all of that, though, I do want to take a quick moment, thank one of my show sponsors, Smile. You know what? I want to talk about Text Expander today. We haven't talked about Text Expander in a while, and it is a critical application for me. I use it every day. It saves me tons of time, and it's particularly relevant because with the iPad 2 out, you might be getting an iPad for the first time, and if you have Text Expander on the desktop, you can take your snippets with you in Text Expander Touch on the iOS, specifically now the iPad 2. And because of how the iPad is set up, of course, you can't have applications running in the background. So you might think, well, how can Text Expander work in the or on the iPad? And what's great is they have an API, an application programming interface, that third-party apps can take advantage of. So I'll just give you one example of an app that I love to use, Textastic. I think I've talked about it on the show. It's a text editor, but it also does code highlighting. I'm a programmer, so I really like that feature. And Text Expander has these great snippets for doing HTML and CSS. As a matter of fact, they just got updated, and you can download those. You can load them into Text Expander on the Mac, and just hitting a few keystrokes, you can do amazing things like insert HTML5 video, and it gives you all of the framework and stuff for doing that in just a few keystrokes, and that's the power of Text Expander. Well, I can get that in Textastic because they took advantage of the Text Expander Touch APIs and have integrated that stuff in there. So easy to sync your text snippets back and forth. You can control which ones you want to bring over to the iPad, and it just works really well. Great software. Also, check out their other stuff when you head over to smilesoftware.com. They have free trials available. You can also take a look at PDF Pen, Disk Label, some of the other great software that I've talked about on the MacCast. And a big thank you to Smile for their support of the show. So what do you say we talk a little bit about iPad 2? New information and details are coming out now that people have had it in their hands. They've been able to run it through its paces. We've had it tore down by iFixit, so we've looked at all the guts and the innards. And probably one of the most striking new aspects about the iPad 2 is the thinness. And Apple was able to do a couple things to get the thinness in there. It was hard to believe that, looking at the original iPad, that Apple could make it even thinner, 33% thinner. So it's not just a little bit thinner, it is significant. And you can really feel that when you hold it. There's a great article over on the Mac Observer covering the teardown by iSupply, another company that tears down the iPads. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. But they say the touchscreen itself saved a lot of space. It's about 25% thinner. As far as the glass goes, there have been some concerns because the glass is thinner, that, you know, is the glass going to be just as strong? Well, one of the articles I was reading speculated that the glass is actually a product from a side glass company in Japan, and it's something called Dragon Tail Glass. So we talked about Gorilla Glass on the prior generation iPad, I think, or am I confusing? Probably might be confusing that with the iPhone 4. So the iPhone 4 is rumored to have this Corning Gorilla Glass that is supposed to be, you know, extra strong. I guess Dragon Tail Glass is the new thing in the iPad 2. I'm going to have to do a little bit more research to figure out what the exact properties of that. But I'm assuming Apple has taken into consideration a material that would be thin and stronger. Another area of space savings was the metal frame. The stamped metal frame is actually thinner. And I don't know if it's just perception or thought behind this, but I have noticed that my Wi-Fi reception in the iPad 2 seems to be a little bit improved. I'm getting a little bit better signal in areas when I have it next to my original iPad. It's showing more bars. That could just be a software thing, but it's feeling like it's getting better Wi-Fi reception. So I don't know if Apple moved the antennas around, what's going on, but it might be just able to pass through the thinner metal frame. Not an engineer, so maybe I'm thinking wrong on that, but it is something I've noticed. And then a lot of savings in the battery. The battery is 59% thinner, and I think I read somewhere it's actually kind of three batteries, and the iPad 2 is mostly battery. The iPad 1 was mostly battery as well, but that seems to be where all of the thinness has come from. A lot of people talking about the performance of the iPad 2, saying it just feels snappier. I've read a lot of comments about it feeling snappier, apps launching quicker. High demand applications and some tasks that are really processor intensive do seem quite a bit faster. I have to tell you, in my usage over the past week or so, I think the real world translation of the snappiness or it feels faster, or I think it's a lot faster comments, really seems to be maybe in most areas a half a second to 1 second to quicker, or those pauses. If you ever use the original iPad and you were doing something, maybe launching an application or trying to pull down a menu, going into the system preference or something like that, and you tap the button and then before stuff comes up on the screen, there's that sort of half a second, 1 second pause. It's those little pauses that are gone. I have to wonder, though, in real world applications, when you're doing stuff for the majority of people, is that going to make enough of a difference to do, say, an upgrade? You got to weigh that into the cost. I guess all those little half-second, one-second pauses can be annoying, and maybe it goes to user experience. It just feels like a better user experience. But honestly, I never felt that my iPad, my first-generation iPad, really felt that slow. I didn't really notice those pauses. I guess you start to notice it when you have something that doesn't do that. Frame rates on games are definitely improved. I tried playing around with Infinity Blade on the new iPad 2, which is a pretty graphically intensive program, and it does feel smoother. The motion feels smoother. But again, here, I didn't notice that on my original iPad playing that game felt bad. It didn't feel like it was slouching or anything like that. So the performance, while it's there, I have to wonder if it's if it isn't being touted as more than it is, at least from my perspective. I will say, though, that a lot of things haven't been optimized for the new hardware. The iPad 2 has a dual-core processor. Most applications aren't taking advantage of the second core, so it's probably running at the same clock speed, 1 gigahertz on the original iPad processor. If you're only using one core of the 1 gigahertz A5 dual core in the iPad 2, then you're still running your processor at 1 gigahertz. So when the more graphically intensive applications, games, image rendering applications, video applications start to take advantage of those dual cores, that's when I think we're going to really see the speed increase. So in a few months, check back. We'll see how the iPad 2 is doing. I think I heard somebody say that some iPad 2 only apps are already showing up on the App Store. And I guess that's another area where having an iPad 2 could be a reason to upgrade to an iPad 2. Software is always one of those reasons. If the software takes advantage of the hardware, or maybe the software only runs on a certain grade of hardware, then you might need to purchase an upgrade. And then on the GPU side, a lot of things are going to be able to take advantage of the GPU. I think that's where the big performance gains are going to be had in the iPad 2s, especially with like video encoding and gaming and things like that. So we're going to have to see how that all shakes out. The screen itself, the iPad screen, has the same specs. A lot of people thought it didn't change. There was an article, one of the presidents or founders, I think, of DisplayMate, a display company, took a look at the iPad 2 display, and I had noticed when I took it out of the box and started comparing it to my original iPad that it did look brighter. Images on the screen seemed to be a little bit sharper, a little bit crisper. And the DisplayMate guys said they did a testing, and they think it has Retina-like display performance. It's not a Retina pixel density. The Retina display on the iPhone 4 has a pixel density of, I think, 326 pixels per inch, if I'm remembering that stat correctly. The iPad 2 still is a 132 pixel per inch, but it just does seem like a really nice display. And DisplayMate claims Apple could even make it better in software by doing some things with the anti-aliasing. There's some third-party developers that have already tweaked their apps. FireMint, the folks who make flight control, reportedly have leveraged some of the software techniques to make the images on the display even better. So you can get really good display performance out of the iPad 2. And I wasn't expecting that just based on the technical specifications, but it certainly is there. The cameras in the iPad 2, you know, I really have to say, I think they're just there to stop people complaining about the fact that the iPad 2 didn't have cameras. It's almost like a bullet point feature, and I'm shocked that Apple would really do that. I guess there's some areas where the cameras will be able to be used and leveraged, but as far as taking actual still shots with them, either the front camera or the rear camera, I think most people are going to be somewhat dissatisfied with the quality that's coming off of them. The rear-facing camera outdoor in really good lighting can take some okay pictures, but really they're going to match up with a really cheap point-and-shoot from 5 years ago. I mean, that's the kind of quality we're talking about on the stills. Now, with the forward-facing camera shooting HD video in good light, especially outside, it does look really nice. It's probably on par with, not with the iPhone 4, but on par with the latest generation iPod touches, and I think most people would be very happy. I think it's kind of on par with a lot of the flash-based 720p high-definition cameras like the ones from Kodak or the flips and things like that. I think the video is pretty comparable to that. So I was disappointed with the cameras. I don't really want to harp on it, but the problem I guess I'm having is that I wasn't expecting a lot from the cameras, and they actually delivered less, and that's not a typical experience that I have with Apple. But it certainly doesn't detract from some of the ways you would use the camera, doing things like barcode scanning in applications. It's going to be very useful for that. It doesn't matter what your image quality is there. The FaceTime, the forward-facing camera for doing FaceTime, on par with the iPhone 4. You know, it's the same VGA quality camera that Apple is using across the board. People are going to be very happy with that. It's great for FaceTime. You just end up with a pixelated, more grainy image than I think you'd like to see in a lot of cases. But for those types of application, it's going to work really well. For adding things into games, for doing augmented reality stuff, the cameras are going to perform just fine, and people are going to be happy with them. But it's definitely not going to replace your point-and-shoot. Not that I ever thought it would. I think I talked about it before the iPad 2 came out, that it doesn't even really make sense for it to have cameras in it in a lot of respects. Again, I think it's this feature that is appeasing a bullet point list, so when it gets held up against a competitor, they can go, okay, camera, check, you know, front-facing camera, check, rear-facing camera, check, we got them both, okay. And Apple's hoping that nobody's going to really pay attention to the image quality, because with a tablet, that's not the thing you're going to be whipping out to take pictures, right? You're going to pull out your iPhone camera or your cell phone camera, or you're going to bring out a pocket point and shoot, or one of these little flip style video cameras, something like that. It's much more convenient. And then you can take that video and bring it into a device like the iPad, and that's where you're going to do your editing. iMovie on the iPad is really nice. I've been playing around with that a little bit. Much better experience. Works just as well as it did on the iPhone, but with the extra screen real estate, you can actually visualize yourself really making videos with this thing. Whereas on the iPhone 4, while it could do it and it did it well, it was just tricky enough with that small screen that you you often didn't even want to bother. You wanted to get that video back to your Mac and work on it there. I think you can work with video on the iPad and do it quite nicely. And with the added processors and the graphics performance, it's going to be a nice machine for doing that sort of thing. So overall, I'm very happy with the iPad 2. I think my three-word review for it, though, would be, it's an iPad. All the things that made the original iPad great are great on the iPad 2 and still great. It's got some nice little enhancements in terms of the processor. Again, I think that's going to be leveraged later on. The cameras aren't anything to write home about. Most impressive thing for me is the form factor. It's lighter, it's thinner, it feels really nice in your hand, and that's a really nice thing. But when someone comes to you and says, do I need to upgrade my iPad 1? It's hard for me to really make that recommendation unless they're really a fan of gadgets and technology and just need to have the latest and greatest thing, or there's some specific application they're looking forward to using that might leverage the dual core processor or something like that. But if you've been using your iPad for doing things like reading books and consuming media, watching Netflix, surfing the web, answering email, doing text documents and things like that, I don't know that the iPad 2 is going to really be leaps and bounds something that's going to give you that much more performance that's worth spending the money on the upgrade. Now, if you are getting an iPad for the first time, yes, the iPad 2 is the thing you want. It's going to be great. And if you want to save some money, they're dropping the prices on the original iPads like rocks. You wouldn't believe it. I think AT&T just came out this week or just today and dropped the price on their 3G models another $100. So I think they're down $200. You can get the 64 gigabyte 3G model on AT&T for $529. That's $300 off, because I think I paid $829 for mine. So some good deals to be had if you want to pick up an iPad 1, but you're certainly not going to be unhappy with the iPad 2. I just don't know that it's, you know, a must-have upgrade. It's a really nice upgrade, and I certainly am enjoying mine. I don't want to give the wrong impressions. Now, if you've decided that you want an iPad 2 and you weren't out there on launch day and you haven't pre-ordered yours online already, you might be waiting a while. That's the one thing. The iPad 2 is arguably a bigger success than the iPad 1, which shocked me. I didn't think there would be that many people rushing to get an iPad 2. I figured the iPad 1s were already out. It wasn't that huge of an upgrade, but people have seemed to have gone crazy. Maybe it's because the competitors just really aren't throwing up anything that's affording competition. The Motorola Zoom is getting kind of mixed reviews. There was a guy in line at the Apple store I was at waiting for my iPad that said his was going back. He just didn't feel that the Honeycomb operating system, the new Android operating system, was quite ready for prime time, and he didn't want to wait. He wanted a tablet device he could really use now. That's not saying that the competition isn't good. It's just saying that the iPad is here now. It's on its second generation. It's a mature product, and I think maybe consumers are responding to that, and people who were holding off, didn't want to buy the first iPad out of the gate, maybe wanted to see what was going to happen, wanted to see if there were bugs that were going to need to be worked out, and realized, you know what, this product is solid. It got rave reviews. I'm ready to jump in and get that iPad. And I think that happened because a lot of the people that I talked to in the line I was at were first-time iPad buyers. They didn't have the original one, but they really wanted to get this one, so they picked it up. I'm still hearing that ship times, and I think I checked this earlier today, ship times on the online store are still 4 to 5 weeks. So if you order now, you're going to be waiting about a month, probably longer, to get your iPad 2. There's still long lines outside Apple retail stores. Apple retail stores do seem to be getting shipments in almost every day in some locations. It really depends on the location you're in. Apple's being really hush-hush about how many they're getting in, where they're getting them in, when they're getting them in, stuff like that. But they're still being reported long lines. Here we are, a week later, and lines in some cases over 100, 200 people in different locations. I had a friend in the Los Angeles area. She really wanted an iPad. I said, you know, I don't know if you're going to be able to get one. She went Thursday and lined up at 4:15 a.m. She said at the store she went to, 4:15 a.m., there was still 26 people in line ahead of her. She was 27th in line. Store doesn't even open till I think 9, 10 o'clock. By the time they did open, they did have iPads. They got to her 27th in line, and her only option was a 16 gigabyte Verizon model. It wasn't exactly the model she wanted, but she picked it up because she wanted to get an iPad that day, didn't want to wait. And she said by the time the doors opened, there were hundreds of people in line. Many more had lined up behind her. So just crazy. And none of the reports or rumors are seeming to indicate that things are going to get better anytime soon. If you remember leading up to the iPad 2 launch, there were already people saying that Apple didn't get as many of the initial shipment as they had wanted. They're having trouble getting component parts. Supplies are constrained. And now with the horrific tragedy that happened in Japan, that looks like it might have some impact. Some of the components for new iPads come out of Japan. You know, and as I say that, that shouldn't even matter. It's part of the news, so I'm reporting it. But, you know, it's hard to sit here and talk about iPads and talk about, you know, we can't get iPads and the supplies are constrained by what happened in Japan. But really, it doesn't matter. I don't know how to say it any other way. What's important is that Japan gets back on its feet. My heart and thoughts go out to the people over there. I know I have some listeners over there. I've gotten reports from them. Luckily, everybody I've talked to, they're safe and they're in recovery mode and they're going to need help recovering. Fortunately, Apple made it easy for us to donate to help the victims over there through the Red Cross. They put a thing on their website and in iTunes. You can go to iTunes and click on the button. You can donate, and please donate if you have the ability to do so. And it can come right out of your Apple account. So you don't even have to give up your credit card information. You can just have it come straight out of your iTunes account. So that's a very Mac geeky Apple way to do that. But you know, these things unfortunately happen. It's part of nature, and we never know when they might happen. So it is going to affect things as Japan gets back on their feet and starts to rebuild and things like that. But iPad 2s are shipping this week. The online orders started arriving. I have reports from some of you saying that you did receive your iPad 2s. It's looking like it's a lot of the people who got their orders in really early on the Apple Store that first day or so. Others are going to be waiting a little bit longer, and still 4 to 5 weeks seems to be the new norm on waiting for an iPad 2. Because of the shortages, a huge gray market is popping up. Unfortunately, anytime something like this happens, you start to see people who just swoop in, buy up iPads, and then flip them. They're turning around and reselling them on Craigslist and eBay. Prices are getting crazy, you know, in the several thousand dollar range in some cases, just to get an iPad 2. And once again, you know, if you have that kind of money, put your order in online, wait, and donate to the Red Cross. Put that money where it really matters, not in acquiring a new iPad 2 from some gray market scammer. But we did see a lot of that. It caused some stress and strain in the lines at different retail stores. The retail store that I was at was limiting purchases to 2 per customer, but I heard reports of other locations where people were swooping up 10. There was, I think, a report out of New York where somebody went through and hired people to get in line to buy iPad 2s, and they were buying them 2 at a time, but several, you know, dozen people were hired in line, so they got a big supply, and they were taking that away from consumers who really just wanted the iPad for their own use. I was frankly shocked that Apple didn't limit to 1 per customer when they were buying, since supplies did seem to be so constrained. As far as how first week sales went, predictions are ranging from 500,000 units all the way up to a million units or more. I don't think, just based on the reports that I've seen, Apple sold a million units. I think a lot of the speculation that Apple maybe received an initial shipment around 600,000 units was probably pretty accurate, at least for the in-store sales. Maybe when you start adding on some of the online numbers, if those do start arriving this week, we could bump it up. But I'd be shocked if we hear a number like a million. No word from Apple yet on that. But all of this demand is definitely driving the stock price. Some analysts at Credit Suisse have set a $500 per share price target rating on Apple stock. So it's good for Apple's bottom line, and definitely a lot of hype surrounding the iPad 2. If you were able to get your iPad 2, I'd love to hear your thoughts, impressions, things like that. And also, if you're waiting on an iPad 2, or maybe you're not going to upgrade, maybe you've decided this one's not for you and you might wait for the next one, I'd love to get your emails and comments and things like that. So send those along if you have a chance. And because the real big story of this week is the news coming out of Japan, I did want to point out something. Apple set up the Red Cross donation thing through iTunes, but they also have been reaching out to their own employees and kind of opening up Apple in ways inside Japan that you wouldn't normally think about. But when I started to see these reports, I thought, yeah, that really is a good way to handle it. Steve Jobs sent a letter out to Apple employees in the region saying, if you need anything, come to us, come to our HR departments, let us know what you need. If you need extra family time, if you need medical things, just let us know about it and we'll see what we can do. And I thought that was really appropriate and poignant and a good thing for him to do publicly. Kevin Rose also posted a story from an Apple retail employee in the region who said, you know, right after the disaster, they were one of the few places, the Apple stores were one of the few places that had electricity, they had internet connectivity, they run their own generators, they can kind of be autonomous, and they opened up the stores to their employees, to their families, let them stay there if they needed a place to stay. They also opened it up to customers to come in, use the internet connection, use the Macs. They said a lot of FaceTime calls were placed to outside the country so people could tell everybody that they were safe and okay. And I thought that was just a great story too. And I'm hearing that Apple's continuing to do that. So I think they really stepped up in a big way, not only through the iTunes donations, but just at a real grassroots level in using the facilities and the things that they had to help the people in the region. So that was a great positive story to hear coming out of Apple this week. A couple weeks ago, Apple released those new MacBook Pros, and they were getting rave reviews in terms of performance and things like that. And now it seems like we're starting to get the bug reports and reports of little glitches and issues plaguing some MacBook Pro owners. A number of things surfaced this week. One interesting one is a home sharing glitch. That's part of the new iTunes update, part of the new iOS update, but some new MacBook Pro owners are reporting losing connections to their libraries on their MacBook Pros after being connected from iOS devices. The recent iTunes update, the iTunes 10.2.1 update, doesn't seem to fix the issue. Fix may possibly be coming, they're saying, in the 10.6.7 update to Snow Leopard, which we're hearing reports is kind of in its final stages of development and testing and things like that. Right now, only temporary workaround seems to be disabling and then re-enabling the home sharing feature in iTunes on the MacBook Pro, and that seems to reset things. But when it goes to sleep or goes away, the home sharing isn't coming back on or isn't reconnecting. May possibly be related. Apple changed some things in Mac OS X to help the wake from sleep when using the home sharing feature. Wake for network activity, I think, is actually what it is in home sharing, and maybe it's related to that, something like that. There's also been reports of some display issues when connecting the new MacBook Pro to a 24-inch LED cinema display, reports of flickering and things like that. It does it whether you're using the AMD GPU or the integrated Intel GPU, so it doesn't seem to be related to that. Often the video glitches on past models have been related to video problems with the dedicated chipsets from ATI, but that doesn't seem to be what's happening in this case. Apple is reportedly investigating this issue. I have to wonder if it isn't related to the new Thunderbolt connector, which is how you would hook up an LED cinema display. Now everything goes through that, you know, it used to be the mini display port. It's the same style connector, but now has that Thunderbolt technology in it. So I don't know, but it sounds like something that Apple can probably fix with software. Other reports of crashing and freezing and kernel panics on some new MacBook Pros seems to be mostly in applications that place high demands on the CPU or the GPU, and it seems to happen even when those applications are running in the background. So I'm not sure what's going on there, but quitting applications when they're not in use can probably help in that situation. There were also reports that using a tool like AppTamer, some software like AppTamer on your Mac, which is an application that allows you to pause those idle applications, when they're in the background, basically shutting down all their access to the resources on the machine. Those reportedly help stop the crashes, freezes, and kernel panics. But another thing that Apple is obviously going to need to address with hopefully a software fix, hopefully these things aren't related to hardware. If you've been experiencing any of these new MacBook Pro bugs and have any insight or maybe workarounds, things like that, please share those. Send them along. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. There actually have been some issues also reported with the new iPad 2s, unfortunately. One of the early ones that started surfacing were yellow colors or yellowing on the screen. This is likely similar to something that we saw when the original iPad shipped, where there's a glue that they use to marry the digitizer tablet and the glass together in the unit. And the items are coming out of Asia so quickly that glue isn't drying, and it should go away. So if you've seen that on your screen, give it a couple days. It should just naturally fade away. If it doesn't, then you probably want to take your iPad back to the Apple retail store. Something that looks similar but is a different issue that's being reported is light leaking on the edge of the LCD. So if you have your iPad in a really dark room and you're looking at the screen, an all black screen, for example, you see this a lot in the opening of movies and things like that, and you're seeing extra light coming in near the edges of the display where it's not quite as dark as it should be. That's what people are reporting as the light leaking. Reports are saying that some people are getting their units replaced for this issue, but oftentimes the light leaking on the new units is worse than the one that they had before. I haven't noticed any of that on my iPad, although I haven't really done testing in a dark room. And some of the reports are saying you need to turn the brightness all the way up. So I think a lot of people might not notice this issue because by default, the auto adjust brightness is on. And when you're in a dark room, it kind of dims the iPad itself down a little bit more. So it wouldn't necessarily be obvious. You'd have to kind of force it to kind of see it. And those types of issues, I guess for some people, are real annoyances. My opinion is that if I'm not going to see it in normal use, if I have to do kind of these freaky steps to get it replicated, I'm not exactly sure how large or widespread an issue is. If you're really critical about that sort of thing, though, you might want to test it out. And if you're not happy with it, definitely take it back to Apple. The only problem at this point is you might be waiting a long time before you get your replacement iPad, so you kind of have to weigh that. A couple other products that haven't been immune from the bugs this week: the Apple TV. There was an update to the Apple TV when iOS 4.3 came out. Some users reported flickering on their televisions when using the HDMI to DVI adapter after the latest iOS update for Apple TV. Apple is reportedly working on a fix. They're aware of the issue, so if you've been experiencing that, you might just have to hold on for a little bit till Apple issues a patch. iPod touch issues. Some people are reporting that their iPod screens seem to flicker and distort after the update. No word on what's happening there or whether or not Apple is working on a fix for that one. And then iOS 4.3 battery issues. I hadn't really thought about this until I started reading this, but my iPhone 4, I've been noticing the battery seems to be going down much more quickly. And I probably didn't notice it because when I was at Macworld, I picked up a new Mophie juice pack for my iPhone 4, and I have been turning that on quite a bit since the iOS 4.3 update, so I'm not sure what Apple did there. I also did notice, and I forgot to mention this earlier when I was talking about my iPad 2, I talked a little bit to Jeff Gamet about this, and he says he sees a similar thing. My iPad 2 still seems to get the same battery life as my iPad 1. It seems to last just as long, but I'm noticing that the battery indicator seems to indicate that it drains quicker, at least on the front end. So the iPad will jump from 100% charge quickly down to 75%, down to 50%, more quickly than I would ever notice on my iPad 1. But then when it starts to get in the 50% and below range, it starts to really slow down. and it'll actually get down to 30%, around the 30% range, and stay there for a really long time until it reaches its full sort of 10-hour battery life that Apple says it gets. I haven't done hard testing on this. It's just more perceived, but it does seem to, like, the battery indicator is draining more quickly. I don't know if that's related to the iOS 4.3 battery issue that people are reporting on the iPhone or the iPod Touch, but just something interesting to note. We had a controversial report post this week from a company called Blaze. They reportedly did some testing on Apple's new version of Safari in iOS 4.3. Apple touted this as the fastest web browser that they've put on the iOS, and Blaze reportedly put it head-to-head with the Android operating system and said that Android actually came out ahead. Now, what's going on is that supposedly they had a proprietary application that they were running on iOS, and this has created a little bit of a controversy because Apple claims that the Safari web browser has the Nitro JavaScript engine enhancements in it, but that third-party web apps and other apps can't take advantage of that. This was also noted earlier in the week when it was reported that web-based apps that are saved to the home screen load faster in Safari than they do when they were added to the home screen. Well, it turns out there's a specific reason for that. John Gruber wrote up a great piece that explains the technical ins and outs of this, but in essence, it comes down to security. The Nitro engine, the Nitro JavaScript engine that Apple enabled in Safari and iOS 4.3 allows pages in memory that are loaded into memory from the web browser to be marked as executable. That's something that's typically disallowed in iOS for security reasons. It could allow remote code execution because something coming over the internet could be put onto the iOS device and then marked in memory as executable and then run, remotely triggered and run. Apple has hopefully sandboxed this in Safari. The assumption is they trust Safari enough and know enough about what's going on in Safari because they wrote the application that they can keep that controlled and sandboxed. Other web apps, things that would be saved to the home screen, what happens is they get a little wrapper put around them, basically an application, a web application wrapper put around them, and they don't have access to that Nitro JavaScript engine stuff. So that's why you're noticing those things run slower. And that would go the same for embedded web stuff that's in apps. Even though it's using the underlying core WebKit that's in iOS 4.3, it's not going to have access to mark those pages in memory as executable, or it's not going to have access to the Nitro JavaScript engine thing. And that's likely where we're seeing these speed differences. In that report, it's also worth noting that in the averages, in the page load averages, Android was only beating iOS by about 1 second in the page load, which is noticeable, but it's not an astronomical speed difference. And I will concede that for some larger sites, some of the Fortune 1000 sites, there was page load differences of 5 seconds or more. And likely the reason for that is because those sites load a lot of JavaScript, mostly related to the ads. And so if you're loading a lot of JavaScript and you're not able to take advantage of the new engine that Apple put in there because you're running inside a web app, then that could account for the differences. But according to their report, those Fortune 1000 sites were loading 84% of the time faster on Android than it was in their proprietary application running the WebKit browser inside of it. And I think the thing to note about this story is you really do have to dig in and you have to look at the analysis and figure out what's going on. Look at sample sizes, look at how they ran their tests and stuff like that. And a lot of that isn't thrown out when it starts getting reproduced on different blogs and in different news sites. All you get is the headline: Android beats Safari browser 84% of the time. And that's what people read and hear and see. And you really need to delve into it. And Apple kind of responded quickly to this one, which is something they typically don't do. They came almost right out and said, well, this is the reason why. And it makes a lot of sense when you start reading like the piece from Gruber and go, okay, this is related to security. And I have to imagine now people are saying, well, why doesn't Apple enable this for third-party apps? It's a complex technical problem, very likely. I mean, I'm making assumptions here, but I think it's a pretty safe assumption that if they just were able to figure out the security stuff and enable this in a way that they're comfortable with within Safari, then they're probably going to tackle the WebKit and the other parts of the operating system next, but they're going to have to roll that out test it, make sure it's ready, and then roll it out to developers. So that could take some time, and they probably didn't want to hold off on putting it into Safari while they figured all that out. They want to get it out there and get the performance up in this latest version, and then maybe when iOS 4.4 comes out, well, it'll be opened up to the other third-party apps. So I think we can hang in there. I'm sure Apple is not trying to ignore getting performance and other things. A lot of people are reporting that this was deliberately done to stop web-based apps. I don't get that impression. I don't think Apple specifically is trying to cripple web-based apps because they don't like them. They've actually supported them very well through their website. You can sign up for just the web developer program, and it's totally free, and you can start developing web apps, and they have a lot of documentation and stuff related to it. I don't think they're just suddenly going to abandon it in favor of apps. As a matter of fact, if you remember, Steve Jobs himself promoted web apps as the way to develop on the iOS devices before we had the App Store. So I'm not buying that they're abandoning that or trying to cripple it. So that's just the other part of this story. I don't think it would come as any shock or surprise if I admitted that I am an unabashed Apple fanboy. I love Apple products, and I love the company. I love what they do most of the time, but every once in a while I have to step up and say, you know what? I think they've just gone too far. And this time around, it's the latest iPhone ad that just came out this week. You know, I have to say there's quite a bit of snark rolled up in this ad, even though it's delivered in pretty much the standard Apple way. But always in the past, the ads have kind of focused on showing you what's great about the iPhone and trying to convince you that you should get an iPhone because it has all this great stuff. This time around, it can best be summarized by the end of the ad where they say, if you don't have an iPhone, well, you don't have an iPhone. And I'm injecting a little more snark into it. It's delivered a little more straight than that. But I'm adding the tone that we all know is really there. They're in essence saying you don't have an iPhone and you should or even more to the point, you should be embarrassed that you don't. And it's funny because the ad points out the fact that they have an app store, like some of these other devices don't have an app store, which they absolutely do. Maybe it doesn't have as many apps, maybe they aren't as fleshed out or as mature as the Apple App Store, but they do have app stores and they have a lot of the same apps. I don't know if specific ones that were pointed out in this ad are available cross-platform, but I just have to say, you know, I love Apple and I love their ads most of the time, but this one was a little bit too snarky even for me. I don't jailbreak my iOS devices, but if there was one feature that I ever really considered jailbreaking for, it was the ability to tether my iPhone and use its 3G connection to provide Wi-Fi to my other devices. And it's looking like the time of that is coming to an end, at least if you're on AT&T. Everybody always said they could never tell who was actually doing tethering. If you would jailbreak your device, you could run an application like MyWi, I think was one of the popular ones, and you could tether your iPhone for free. Now, AT&T added tethering with the iOS 4.3 update. You can now tether your iPhone officially, and I guess they're wanting to put an end to the non-official tethering. They reportedly sent out letters to customers who are using the tethering feature without paying for it. The letter said, "Our records show that you use this capability but are not subscribed to our tethering plan. If we don't hear from you, we plan to automatically enroll you into our Data Pro 4GB plan after March 27th, 2011. The new plan, whether you sign up on your own or whether we automatically enroll you, will replace your current smartphone data plan, including if you are on an unlimited data plan," which means anybody on an unlimited data plan who's been using the tethering feature, if they don't contact AT&T and you get one of these letters, I guess they're going to take that away from you, which means you can't have your unlimited plan. So if you value that and you've been doing this, you probably want to respond to AT&T's letter. The funny thing is no one's really quite sure how AT&T can tell that you're doing it. One theory is they're just looking at usage, and this is going out to real heavy users. I doubt they're doing that. A more logical one that I've heard is that maybe they're using the browser identification strings or the headers in the browser that get sent out, which they could take a look at, which would tell them that you're using a desktop browser on your iOS device. But I would imagine you could argue that there's applications you can run on your iOS, if you're maybe not Safari browser, but you can run other browsers. I think I have iCab on mine that allows me to change those headers and have it look like my iPhone was a Windows machine running IE. So you can change those headers, and you could probably argue, well, I just do that. Another theory is that it's showing a different time to live unit on the packets that have been traveling across, and maybe AT&T's using that. Whatever the reason, it sounds like they're sending out these letters. If you received one of them, you know, I'm not gonna narc you out or anything like that, but I'd love to take a look at one or just hear from somebody who received one and find out how you're going to respond. So forward that along if you're so inclined. Now the iPad 2 is out. I guess the next thing we need to talk about is the new iPhone. iPhone 5 rumors are starting. They've been going on for a while, but they're starting to heat up now. This week we heard some reports that there are early case design leaks, and they're showing that there's very little in the way of design changes, at least when it comes to physical placement of components and just the overall shape. Identical button placements, the SIM slots is reportedly still in the same position, the camera holes still in the same positions, which is good news for case manufacturers. The one large change that's being reported is that Apple will be moving away from the glass back on the case and back to a metal casing, a flat metal back case. And we've seen some mocked up images and things like that surfacing online of that. I don't know if they're mocked up images or just early reported prototypes of the flat back metal case. And I have to imagine if they figured out a way to make those thinner and offer better wireless signal transparency to them, then that may be a way for Apple to go. If that's the case of what I'm seeing with my iPad 2, then they could go back to the metal case, because it's always been a problem for those signals getting out. The other thing that I heard reported is that it might have a larger screen. Some of Apple's competitors have a 4-inch screen, so going edge to edge, I don't know how they would actually accomplish that. The current iPhone has just a slight edge. But I don't know if just extending it out to the edge would be enough to make that a 4-inch screen. I guess they could extend it top and bottom a little bit as well. I don't know. These things are measured diagonally, so I guess that would give them a little more space. The current iPhone, I think, has a 3.5-inch screen. A 4-inch screen would be significantly larger, and I would imagine have to change the form factor of the device. So I'm not putting a whole lot of stock into a larger screen. I think Apple might stick with the 3.5 Retina display. It's a pretty nice display. Haven't heard too many complaints about it from many people. The processor, I think, somewhat obviously, will be the dual-core A5, just like in the iPad 2. I would also assume that Apple would be using the same graphics chips that are in the new iPad. Near-field communication, that seems to be the big buzz that's up in the air. It was kind of on again, off again. There were rumors Apple was going to include near-field communication for doing mobile payments, micropayments, and things like that. You'd be able to just walk up to a unit and wave your iPhone around and make a payment. I would assume that money would come right out of your iTunes account, so you wouldn't have to provide any additional information to use that payment system. That was reportedly then off again by some of the rumor sites, and then late this week they said nope, near-field communication still in there. Along with being the payment system thing, though, it also is going to enable remote login into systems. A new one that one of the original stories I had kind of heard about this would be the concept of kind of having a mobile home directory, or at least parts of your home directory that would kind of travel with you with your iPhone, and then when you got near a Mac, you could log in, or actually the iPhone would log you into that Mac, and then you'd have access to your desktop and your documents and things like that, maybe stored in the cloud through a service like MobileMe, something like that. So I really like that concept. It's something I think could be very useful. But even maybe more useful is what is being called remote guest login, which would give you temporary access to the applications you bought through the Mac App Store. So your phone would kind of be the key when you got to a guest Mac, maybe at a friend's house or something like that. You might be staying for the weekend and you brought your iPhone in range and it detected it. It could see, oh, there's your iTunes account. I know the applications that you own. Let me install them on this machine here so that you can use them. Again, I assume this would be coupled with documents for those applications and information that would be stored in the cloud, maybe on your Mobile Me account. You'd be able to access your documents, work on them, use them with the software that you purchased. And then when you left or you walked away with your iPhone, that stuff would all be cleaned off and removed from the guest system, so not leaving any traces of what you had done. So that's another very interesting concept, and this could all happen just by having your phone with the near-field communication technology near the host device. So those are some of the latest inklings on what we might see in the next generation iPhone. We're not going to have to wait too long for that, because I would assume Apple is going to make an announcement sometime early this summer. They usually do it during WWDC, which tends to happen around the June timeframe. You may have noticed that a lot of these technologies, the near-field communication technologies, and some of the other new rumored services and things like that that I've been talking about really depend on and sort of rely on what Apple is going to do in the cloud, and most of that is probably related to Mobile Me. iLounge is reporting that they have a trusted source within the educational circle who says that Mobile Me is going free and it's going to be happening pretty soon. He's saying that their suppliers are telling them that Mobile Me is no longer available for purchase, and they're recommending that any new users that they need to sign up simply sign up for the 60-day free trial that's available. You may remember that Apple started pulling the Mobile Me boxes from its retail stores a couple weeks ago, and online on the website, it does seem like the 60-day trial is what is being offered. You still have the pricing and stuff up there, as far as I know, at least as of the time I was recording this. And when you do that, you get the 60-day trial. So if there's a window within the next month where they make the service free, they could be switching people over to that, and that would help them launch some of these other services. That's reportedly going to happen in the next month or so. So we're going to have to watch out for that one. Apple would also reportedly support existing subscribers to the paid service who have already paid up through the next year. So some of the sites are speculating that indicates there might be two services, the current existing Mobile Me service that has all the features that exist today, and then this new service, which would be free, which would be different in some way or different enough in some way to make it, I don't know if it would be less of a value or somehow avoid Apple having to issue a bunch of refunds on the existing plans. So really just rumors at this point, but you know that data center in North Carolina is reportedly getting ready to go online soon has to be related to some sort of cloud initiative from Apple. Mobile Me makes the most sense. Whether or not they make it free or not, sounds like we might find out in the next month or so. So stay tuned on that one. And that's kind of it for the news for this week. Man, we had quite a bit to talk about. We're running in about an hour already. I have a bunch of other things that I want to get to, so we might run long on this show. I hope you don't mind. Most of you really don't most of the time. So hang on. The first thing I wanted to start off talking to you about in the feedback section today is the Mac Mini. You know, this is a Mac and Apple's lineup that I think kind of still gets no respect from a lot of people. A lot of people really, really revere it. I'm one of those people who think that the Mac Mini is one of the better products that Apple makes, but I think it gets passed over with sexy things come along like the MacBook Air or the iPad 2 or the new MacBook Pros. And you've got the Mac Mini sitting over there, just kind of, hey, I'm over here. I'm still the same. I haven't changed too much, but I'm old reliable. And I think that's really the point. It's old reliable, and that's why I have a lot of respect for the Mac Mini. I still have my 1.6 gigahertz Core Duo machine. Not Core 2 Duo, Core Duo machine. And it's a workhorse. It's been running great. I have it set up as my home theater Mac now, and it just sits there, and it does what it needs to do, and it served me well for this podcast for 3 years before that. I recorded every podcast on it, and it just held up. It was nice and quiet, didn't heat up, didn't have any issues with it. And that's what I think. I very rarely hear issues from people who have Mac Minis. And that's not to say that issues don't exist. I know there's Mac Minis out there that have had problems, but I don't know if it's because it's less complex. You don't have things like LCDs. You don't have really high-end dedicated GPUs. They're kind of old, tried-and-true processors. A lot of the components are proven, have been around for a while. It's not the latest and greatest stuff. It's not that bleeding-edge technology that I think sometimes gets you into trouble. I mean, those are the things where software patches have to come out, and there's scenarios that don't get discovered in testing, or they have a bad batch of these new things because they haven't worked out the manufacturing process, and those cause some of those reliability issues. And the Mac Minis don't seem to have that. You know, bring your own screen, bring your own keyboard. It's kind of nice. If you do have a problem with your LCD, guess what? You can replace it, and you're not replacing the components in your Mac. And it in some areas is on par with the iMacs. You've still got the FireWire 800 ports. You have four USB ports. You have the SD card slot. Maybe it doesn't have the same processor or the highest end processor, but for a lot of applications, it's more than what most people need. It works fabulous as a media center machine, especially this latest round of Mac Minis. They have built-in HDMI ports. Built-in HDMI ports. So for connecting to a television, it's absolutely the way to go. Everything else, you've got mini display port, you've got to use an adapter. And the new server version has those dual 500 gig hard drives. So if you want to load a ton of media on it and just serve up your iTunes media, this is a great machine for doing that. It really is. And plus you get the server operating system. So if you want to roll your own mail server or web server, you have that on top of it, and it comes all at the one price. About the only thing I wish on the latest generation of Mac Minis is that they came with a little bit more RAM. They're standard at 2 gigabytes. It'd be nice if Apple bumped that up to 4 gigs. They are upgradable to 8 gigabytes, so you can get a decent amount of RAM in there, and they're pretty easy to upgrade. I would get third-party RAM. I wouldn't necessarily buy it from Apple. Go ahead and get the 2 gigs and then upgrade afterwards. Pricing could be a little bit better, especially considering the fact that it's got some older technology in there. Apple doesn't really drop prices on their machines, so they either need to rev them back up, maybe put some of the new Core i3 or i5 processors in there, and maybe the new Intel integrated GPUs, give that a little bump. Mac Mini seems overdue for that, or drop the price a little bit. I think $699 on the bottom end, still a really good price for a really rock-solid machine. $999 for the server version, which is great if you need the extra storage space and have an application for that. But I guess what I just want to say is don't just bypass the Mac Mini when you're looking at that shiny new iMac. You might be able to save a little bit of money. I think the iMac starts in at $1,199, if I'm not mistaken. You can spend $699 on your Mac Mini, get a nice, good third-party LCD display for just a couple $100 more, and you'd end up with a really nice machine, and you wouldn't have to worry about it being kind of an all-in-one system where if the LCD goes out, you're kind of out of luck for the whole computer. So a nice option, I think, for a lot of applications, and something that maybe doesn't get the attention it deserves. With the iPad 2 out now, I did get an email from a listener who wanted to know about accessories and compatibility of accessories, and I thought that was a great topic. It was covered really well by Macworld. There's an article by, I think, Dan Frakes over at Macworld, and a great subject. So what does work with the new iPad 2, and what are you maybe going to have to replace? And I have to say, overall, most accessories kind of should work just fine with the iPad 2. You've got the power adapters. If you had an iPad 1 and you have the 10-watt power adapter, that should continue to work, whether it's Apple's or a third-party one. Well, we know Apple's will work, but even third-party ones should continue to work just fine. Any accessories made for the iPad 1 that will charge on that 10 watts should charge just fine. It should charge the iPad 2 just fine, I guess is what I want to say. Headphones and inline microphones that are Apple iDevice compatible should also work. Bluetooth headphones, if you have the A2DP support for stereo Bluetooth headphones, and speaker systems that support that A2DP Bluetooth technologies, those should continue to work just fine. New dock connector mics are actually coming out. A couple of companies announced those, I think specifically for use with GarageBand. Apogee, I think, is one of those companies. So if you're looking for a dock connector mic, those are new and will work with the iPad 2. USB mics, you can connect via the camera connection kit, just like you could with the iPad 1. if they're low-powered mics, if you have a more high-powered mic, something that draws more power, you can connect that to a powered hub and then connect that into the iPad connection kit, and that should work. Dock accessories, as long as it fits in the dock, and that might be where the tricky part is, depending on how the device connects into the dock, the iPad is quite a bit slimmer. The dimensions, the physical dimensions, width and height, I think, are the same, but because of the slimness, it might not line up with your dock connector. It might be wobbly or loose in there. Be very careful if you're trying to dock your new iPad 2 into an older dock accessory that's like that. You don't want to do anything to bend or break the pins, but if it fits, it should continue to work, and that would be docks and speaker systems and stuff like that. I was able to get my iPad 2 into the Apple keyboard dock. It seemed to fit okay. In the Macworld report, they said they had to kind of jam it in. I didn't have to do that, but it was a little bit trickier to line it up just right. And the keyboard dock has sort of a thing that sticks up to hold the back of the iPad up. That was a little bit further away, so it was a little bit more wobbly. I worried about maybe some of the strain that would put on the dock connector, but it seemed to work fine when I was using it. They did report, Macworld did report, that if you had a skin or any other kind of thing on there, it wouldn't line up. The tolerances on that are really tight, which might be exactly why it continues to still work. If you have a dock accessory where you can't dock it in, you know, straight in like you could the original iPad, you might take a look at getting a dock extender cable. Companies like Radtech and Cable Jive make these little 30-pin male-female extender cables, so you can sort of get it out of the dock. You just have it sitting on the side. Might look a little bit strange, but it could allow you to continue to use that iPad docking speaker system that you have. The one thing with the cable extenders is they may not deliver power to the iPad, so you're going to have to check that, and it'll depend on the accessory. Cases, I think because of the new design of the iPad 2, a lot of cases aren't going to work. If you have hard shell cases or wraps or skins, things like that, they're not going to quite fit. If they wrap around the back, they're not going to have the spaces for the camera holes, which are new, and maybe even around the front edge, depending on the case design. Slip covers and bags and things like that should continue to work because, again, the physical dimensions of the iPad in terms of width and height are not really changed. It's only thinner, so they might wobble around a little bit more in that slip cover, but the slip cover should continue to still fit over it. So I think that's kind of all the classifications of accessories. If I missed something, or if you have an accessory you've discovered works or doesn't work with the iPad 2, let us know. Send your comments and suggestions and emails along. Before the iOS 4.3 update, there was this really cool feature that was reported to be coming, and that was a new gesture for the iPads. It was a four-finger swipe that would allow you to do a number of different things. A four-finger swipe up would bring up the multitasking bar. Four-finger swipe left or right would allow you to quickly switch between open applications that were running in the background, and it sounded like it was going to be really great. And then at the last minute, or what seems like the last minute, Apple pulled the feature and said, nope, this is a developer preview feature. We're just testing around with it. It's not available to the general public, and it isn't going to be in the iOS 4.3 update. Well, it turns out there's a relatively simple way to enable this if you'd like. I read about it, and then Mark sent along this tip.
Hey, Adam, this is Mark. I love your show. Just wanted to forward over a tip I saw on Engadget or the Apple web blog, the official web blog. It's basically an iPad tip. If you want to show the to be able to use the five-finger swipe to move to different applications and to close by pinching your five fingers, close the applications, I saw that you can buy the developer's tools on the Mac website. And for $5, you can download the developer's tools. It's kind of a big file. It's like 4 gigs, but it's available on the App Store. Then download that and then sync your iPad, and voila, it becomes a developer's iPad. And then it's you can do those different kinds of gestures. I'm going to be buying my iPad 2 in a few days, and I'm wondering whether or not it's going to be the same thing for that one, but I just wanted to pass this along. Thanks a lot. I love your show.
Thanks, Mark. You know what? I can confirm it does work with the iPad 2. I enabled it. I'm in Apple's developer program, and I used Xcode. I did a little bit differently than you. I didn't purchase it for $4 through the App Store. I'm enrolled in the program, which is $99 a year, so I was able to launch Xcode with the iPad connected. Comes up, asks if I want to use that as a developer device. I say yes, and then when you go into the settings, what happens after you do that is you go into the settings on the iPad, and you'll see a new option that's under the general settings that says to enable the multitasking gestures, which gives you those new features of doing the four-finger swipe. Oh, I almost forgot. There's also the pinch to close. So if you're in an application and you just pinch it with four fingers, it will bring you back to the application launch screen, the home screen. And so I really appreciate the tip. It's really cool. But after playing with it for a while, I see why it's in beta and why they wanted to give it to developers to test and play around with for a while, because a lot of developers are going to have to update their applications to not register these four-finger swipes. What's happening in a lot of the applications I'm using, especially when I'm trying to do the switch between applications with the four fingers, it's misregistering my four fingers and doing things like zooming or changing things in the applications that normally would change with a two-finger pinch type gesture. Nebulous Notes is an obvious example of this for me. I was using it to try and do some notes for the MacCast, and one feature it has is you can change the font size in Nebulous Notes by doing a pinch. Well, every time I'd try and switch back to Reader to read an article and do some research for some of the stuff I was trying to write in my notes, when I'd do the four-finger swipe, it would change my font size to a really huge font size. And that got really annoying going back and forth. So while you can enable the feature and it's relatively easy to do so, I think beyond just playing around with it and seeing how cool it is, it's really not ready for prime time for most users. Your own experiences may vary though. And thank you, Mark, for sending along the tip either way. Now, one thing I get to do as part of the MacCast is I get to review products, and companies will send me products to review. Oftentimes I have them, I get to keep them for whatever reason, and I'll always let you know when I do the review if it's something that a company has sent me. Typically what happens to those is I give them away either through the MacCast, or a lot of times I take them to my Mac user group and give them away, because I just don't need all this stuff, to be honest. But every once in a while, there's products that I do need to send back. And inevitably, if it's something I like, I know when it's a product that I really like, when I take a little bit longer than I normally should to do the review, mainly because I don't want to send the product back. And this time around, the product is the Audio Engine N22s. These guys sent me this unit. What it is they call it a premium desktop audio amplifier. It's not a speaker system. It's actually an amplifier. And I've been using the system in my office for the past couple weeks, and I absolutely love it. Along with it, they sent along a pair of their Audio Engine P4 passive bookshelf speakers. Those run about $249. But the desktop amplifier itself, what's cool about it is if you already own a really good set of speakers, this gives you the ability to set up a satellite speaker system, have a desktop speaker system that sounds really nice to plug into your Mac, and it can fill a room with pretty good sound. The unit provides 22 watts RMS or 40 watts peak per channel, so it's not super powerful. You don't have a lot of watts in there, but it's enough to drive really good sound, especially through the Audio Engine speakers or another set of speakers that you might have. And a lot of us have these speaker systems that we bought to hook up to our home theater systems, and we maybe have extra speakers lying around. Why not repurpose those and turn them into a really good audio system for your iPod, your iPhone, your iPad, or your Mac? I have to say, when I opened up the package, it's beautifully packaged. The unit itself comes in this really nice bag. You pull it out. They've done a really good job with the packaging. I always appreciate that, being an Apple fan. Apple does such a great job with their packaging, and it's nice to see when third-party developers that support the Mac and Apple fans like us do a great job with their packaging as well. It comes with all of the cables that you need, which is really appreciated by me. They have an eighth-inch audio cable in there, an RCA cable, as you hear in a second. There's a number of ways you can connect audio into this. They even include speaker wire, so You have those speakers, you're going to have the wire that you need to hook them right into the unit. Setup was really easy. The design of the unit is really compact, too. It stands vertically, really simple on the front. All you have is a giant analog volume knob and the headphone jack. So you take it out, you plug it into power, you connect the speakers. They have gold-plated binding posts for cooking in the speakers, so that's really easy to do. And then you connect an audio source, and there's a number of ways to do that. I started with my iPod. I just plugged it directly into, has an 1/8-inch line-in input jack on the back. They give you that 1/8-inch to 1/8-inch cable, so you plug that that into the back. You plug the other end into the headphone jack on your iPod or your iPhone, iPod Touch, hit play, and immediately the sound coming out of it was great. You could turn it up really loud. For my office, it's not a huge room, but it certainly filled the room and was loud enough to be uncomfortable. I could not turn it up all the way to maximum volume for very long, but what was great is I could put it on maximum volume and it was crystal clear, great sound, and no distortion. And I think that's a testament to really not overdriving the speakers, not putting so much power behind it that you can just kind of blow things out and make it sound really bad. You don't need to do that. So Audio Engine has always done a great job with sound, and I was expecting great sound from the N22, and it certainly delivered in that regard. Another nice thing, though, is you can also go from line in on, say, a dock. So if you have one of Apple's really nice docks with the line out, you can come out of that, go into the 1/8-inch jack on the back, or go into the RCA connectors and get really great line level sound. And as a bonus, there's a USB port on the back of the N22 for charging. So you'll be able to plug that in. You'll have the power coming from the wall into the N22 and then get power for charging your iOS device right off the unit itself. It makes it really great, again, for setting up as in a satellite situation. So if you have a room where you just want to dock an iPhone or an iPod Touch and get some great sound in that room, this is certainly a way to go. As far as other connectors, there is a set of RCA line out connectors on the back as well. But where things got really interesting for me was when I went wireless. Now, you can do that in a couple different ways. Audio Engine has some companion products, the Audio Engine W2, which is a sender and receiver for iOS devices. You get a sending unit that docks into the 30-pin dock connector on your device, and then a receiver that is basically a little USB dongle with an 1/8-inch line-in port on it that you connect to the other end. In this case, you would plug it into the USB connector that's right on the back of the N22 and then do the line in, and then you could wirelessly send audio from any iOS device directly to the unit, and that works beautifully. They also have the W1s, which is similar but is for having line level components on both ends. So if you want to plug in a line in source and then wirelessly send that audio over to the unit, you can do that. In my case, I have an AirPort Express, and so I connected my AirPort Express into the unit through the 1/8-inch jack and used the AirPlay technology that's built into iOS, and it works awesome. It is so cool. That coupled with the home sharing, I'm able to grab my iPhone. I can pull up the playlist and all my audio through home sharing that's on my Mac on my desktop, and then wirelessly send that audio through AirPlay to the AirPort Express plugged into the Audio Engine N22. And it sounds just great. Another thing that you can do if you want to send audio from, say, your Mac and any source audio, not just the stuff that's in iTunes. Of course, with iTunes, you could use a similar thing. You could use the AirPlay to the AirPort Express. But grab a copy of Airfoil from Rogue Amoeba, and that'll allow you to send audio from any source on your Mac. So I found a great piece of software for playing Pandora Radio called Pyrecast on the Mac App Store. And so I can use that application, pipe it through Airfoil, and send that over to the Audio Engine speakers so I can listen to Pandora Radio on a great set of speakers in my office. And if you don't want to spend the money on an AirPort Express or the W2 or W1s from Audio Engine, and you have an older iPod Touch or iPhone lying around, There are Airfoil Speakers, which is an iOS app that you can run on your device that'll, in essence, turn it into a wireless receiver for Airfoil. So you can send your Airfoil audio from your Mac to Airfoil Speakers and then just plug your iPhone or your iOS device into the N22 and get the audio over that way. So lots of ways to send audio over wirelessly. The other way I was able to use the speakers is, unfortunately, not directly with my new Apple TV 2, because the Apple TV 2 only has a digital out, an optical out on it. But I could connect the N22s to the line out on my television set. So I have the HDMI audio going into my TV set and then the audio out from my TV set going into the N22s to give me better audio for my TV. So you don't have to necessarily hook it up to a Mac. You can also set it up as some rear channel speakers in a surround sound system. You could use the unit that way. So very versatile unit, very compact, easy to move around, great sound, great quality. I wouldn't expect anything less from Audio Engine. They make really great audio products. The price, it's $199. So not the cheapest way to go. But if you already have a really good set of speakers that are just going to waste, this could be a great way to repurpose them, and you can set up a remote audio zone in your house. And if you look at some of the competitive higher-end audio zone products out there, that pricing is actually, it could end up being cheaper for you, and it's going to do a better job than buying one of these cheap sort of powered speaker systems, 2.1 systems or something like that, and you can reuse some of your old gear. So it offers, I think, a lot more versatility and does it in a really great quality product that delivers really great sound and is easy to set up and use. So I definitely loved mine, and I'm going to be sorry to see them leaving. Maybe I can work out a deal to make a purchase from Audio Engine. I don't know. We'll see. Stay tuned on that. But if you want to check them out, I'll have a link to them in the show notes at maccast.com. And then finally today, you know, I am always amazed by the depth of knowledge and experience that is in the Mac community, and specifically, in this case, the MacCast community. You guys are really talented people out there, and you know a lot about stuff. And I always find it interesting to kind of hear about legacy stuff, some of the history of Apple, and how that impacts what is happening in the current Apple ecosystem and things like that. And a lot of times this relates to questions that I get asked, and that kind of happened to me this week. I've exchanged some emails with the person that you're going to hear me talk to here in a second, and he had a particular issue that he was dealing with. It was related to some software that he works on for a company, and software that's been around in the Mac community for a really long time. But a common question I get asked about is how to open documents that maybe someone created and saved a long time ago, and they're in some sort of legacy format, and they're on a newer Mac system, maybe a new Intel Mac, and that application doesn't exist anymore. It comes up very commonly for people who had applications that maybe ran in OS 9. And the applications don't exist anymore, but they have data and stuff and files that they've worked on for a really long time. And actually, probably more often what I get asked about is, you know, why can't we have older formats that work, or that we can at least extract data from, or that there's some third-party tool to get that data out? You know, why does this stuff get lost and or is not supported anymore? And, you know, the short answer, it's a complex answer, but the short answer, unfortunately, is often, you know what, they just aren't supported anymore, and we just have to move on. It's just time to move on. And it's not what most people want to hear, but it does become the reality of the situation. And it also does point out the fact that we do need to think about longevity of our data. And I think I did a show on this a while back, but we haven't talked about it in a while. And that is, we need to consider, if we have documents and we have information that we want to live for a long time, we either need to do some forward thinking about the formats that we put things into and think about, are these going to be around, or is there going to be a way for me to extract this data in the long term? Or we need to think about, you know, I need to format shift, or I need to change this data over time. And so this conversation that you're going to hear has a lot of this stuff in it. And it's also very interesting to explore this stuff. It has a little bit of history. It has a little bit of insight into some of these issues. It has a happy ending to this story, because it turns out that Apple did some things in the end that are going to enable this particular person to bring along the data, this legacy data, or get it into a new format that's going to be supported and bring a feature back to the application that had been lost for a little bit of time. So enter into the conversation now, Glenn Howes. He's a listener. He has a great insight on these issues, as I mentioned, because of his issues. So this is part history lesson, part technical geekery. We get into some low-level stuff and also a little bit of a cautionary tale and just a glimmer of hope as to how we might be able to deal with these things. So I hope you enjoy this. Let me know if you do. I will tell you right now, it runs about 30 minutes, so I know we've got a long show, but I just had a really great time talking to Glenn. I think you're going to enjoy this conversation. So hang in, and if you don't have time, you might want to pause now and pick this up later. But here's my conversation with Glenn Howes. All right, I want to welcome to the podcast Glenn Howes. Hey, Glenn, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah?
Thank you. How are you doing, Adam?
I'm doing good, too. Glenn sent me an email. He works for a company. They make a product called ChemDraw, which has been around in the Mac community for years. As a matter of fact, Glenn, I don't know. I think I told you this on email. My wife was a chemist in college, or studied chemistry, I guess I should say. She still is technically a chemist, I guess, but is no longer practicing, as it were.
I always say I'm trained as a chemist, but I've forgotten more chemistry than I remember.
Exactly. And so I'm intimately familiar with ChemDraw because I had a Mac in college and she wanted me to get it up and running so she could work on stuff when she wasn't at the lab or at school. Mm-hmm. And so I've used the product. I'm aware of it. But this is more, I think, a deeper conversation a little bit about... I think documents and document formats and longevity, and also you want to highlight sort of an underlying change that sort of caused a legacy problem for some of your customers, right?
Well, yeah. I sent Adam an email, and I said, here, I have this problem that my users have been having for the last several years, and here's what caused it, and here's what the solution is going forward. And I sent you an email that sort of did in timeline form. I'll just summarize that here, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so it all started off, and when Mac was introduced, we had the PICT clipboard format. And a PICT clipboard format is basically just, you draw some things in QuickDraw, which is the original Mac drawing package, and it records them, and it puts them into a blob, and then you can pass that blob around from application to application. And that would allow, you know, this amazing technology of 1984, you could copy and paste a picture from one application, switch to another application, and paste it. And so for up until the middle of the when OS X was introduced, that was what people used. People used various gradual improvements of PICT to copy and paste between applications, and it gradually improved. They added color, you know, when the color max came up. And at one point or other, they, I guess I'm getting off track here. The important part here was that the PICT format allowed you to embed your own data, the application to embed its own special data. So if I make a selection, I copy it, I paste it in another application, and then later on I copy from that application and paste it back into my originating application, the original application say, oh, where's my data? And it can recreate the original selection. Because otherwise, it would just be a dead document. And in the case of ChemDraw, we know we have atoms and bonds. And we have all sorts of information that isn't just drawing information. And if we don't put that into our pasteboard format, it's just become this dead image. And with not so much use to the user, because the user cannot paste it back into our application and oh, I want to modify this chemical drawing. I want to add another bond to it. They can't do that anymore, because if that information was not in return to the to our application.
Okay, wait. So just I want to clarify this, because I'm trying to understand it, and I want our audience to understand it. So under the old PICT format, and people who have been around using the Macs for a long time are really familiar with PICT, P-I-C-T. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Format, so they probably know what we're talking about. Maybe more recent users of the Mac aren't familiar with this, and you're going to kind of understand why, I think, after we have this conversation. But so what you're saying is that when I would use an application like ChemDraw or some of the other Apple drawing programs, I could then copy that. It would copy into the PICT format, but it sounds like it also picks up some metadata. The developers had the ability to embed some specific metadata for their application within that PICT format. Am I kind of understanding that right from a basic level?
That's very, very. That's very. Now the host app, the application you posted in it, would never touch that. If all they had to do was just keep the original round, and when they were asked for it again, be copied, just put the original back on the clipboard, and the originating app could extract it, and you could just go on your business editing what you made.
Right.
And so what happened is, Apple was acquired by Next. Oh, wait a second. No, Apple.
Apple acquired Apple, Next. You got it.
I know. I'm just joking about that. Apple acquired Next, and they had OS 10, and they completely revamped how they did drawing on OS 10 for the better. Okay, they went to a PDF based system of rendering, which is the Quartz system, and it is much more beautiful and elegant and expressive than QuickDraw. So no, I'm not complaining about the existence of PDF, but they deprecated the PICT format, and they replaced it with PDF. Now, when they did that, they didn't give developers any kind of tools or guidance in where in the world we're supposed to put our metadata. Because, basically in the situation is that Apple provides you the tools to generate a PDF. You open up a PDF object with the standard API. You start drawing, lines and text and whatever random things you want to draw, and you close it, and then you have a PDF, and you can put that PDF on the clipboard. But they didn't give you any mechanism to put your own data in that PDF,
mm-hmm.
other than you could put the name, you could put the title, the author, the originating program, some very limited amount of stuff that wouldn't help you recreate your original selection. And so Cocoa applications, which were new, had no real concept of PICT at all. And if they preserved the PICT, that was pretty lucky. And so the new Cocoa applications, they all know about PDF, and they store the PDF, and they didn't have any idea that people would want to round trip edit their clippings, their pasteboards,
right?
And so when this sort of came to a head when Office 2004, its lifespan ran out, and Office 2008 came around, and all of a sudden we got this huge amount of bug reports, from all our users saying, "Hey, I had this Word document, and I copied this image in it, and I pasted it into your program, and in the old days, I could do things like add bonds to it and stuff, and now I can't. I cannot do that anymore. This must be a problem with you."
Right. Can I ask a question? A question about that? So I understand. So I can completely understand how the round tripping works. So I've created a document in my original program. I've copied it. I've pasted it now into a Word document, a Word 2004 document. So everything's going along swimmingly. If I wanted to edit that original ChemDraw and I wanted to add those extra bonds prior to this change, would I just go back to my original ChemDraw file, edit it, and then those changes would show up in Word? Or we're talking about something different. I have to go into Word, copy that out, put it back into ChemDraw, make my edits, and then so it's a copy back and forth thing.
Well, the first thing you describe is sort of like, no, the first thing, it's actually the second thing. It's much more simple than in process editing. Apple had, at one point, they were trying to do OpenDoc, which would have done what you described.
Right. Okay.
And that failed miserably.
Yeah.
And on Windows, they have ActiveX and Olay. And I guess Olay would be the closest correspondence to that. But on the Mac, it's basically been you can retrieve your original image and paste it back into the original programming, and that's how you can edit it again.
Great. Okay. So and this was all enabled through this extra metadata that the Word wouldn't touch. You guys could put in there that bond information. It wouldn't touch it, but it would be embedded there. So when I went and copied that back to the clipboard and brought it back into the original application, it would be there. So the change now is we moved to 2008, Office 2008. Your customers are opening up their old 2004 documents, and that data is now not there.
It's obliterated.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, whenever they converted the five, you know, you can imagine Microsoft's problem with this is that they want to have these documents be interchangeable with Office on the PC. And they're supposed to somehow support this dead and dying PIC format.
Right.
And so, you know, it's completely understandable that it would have been a huge hassle for them to maintain it when it says right in, you know, Apple's header files that the PIC format is completely deprecated.
Deprecated, it's going away.
Yeah. So, 2008 was very problematic because even if I gave it a PDF, if I had somehow managed to put my data into a PDF, the Word 2008 wouldn't have given me back that same PDF. If you select an image in Word 2008, it will re-render it into a PDF, even if it's just the image by itself, as if it were, you know, the entire page or two or three images together. Because it doesn't have any special code to say, oh, this is a PDF. I'll just put it back on the pasteboard by itself. It doesn't have that kind of, you know, thought behind it. And you can see that's an extra step. You know, is my selection a single PDF? Oh, I will just put it on the clipboard as an extra bit of programming.
Right.
And my boss spent a huge amount of time. You know, exchanging email with Microsoft, you know, trying to come up with a solution, exchanging email with Apple, trying to come up with a solution. And basically, because, you know, in order to transform from to a new system, which would obviously be PDF based, because that's the clipboard format of choice for vectored file formats, then Apple would have to provide some mechanism to add extra data to PDFs, and then applications that took data in would have to be, be programmed to just return the original, and programs that created images would have to be programmed to add the data to it and also to extract it.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a huge interoperable stuff, and I myself spent you know a lot of time talking to people trying to get them interested in the problem. You know, I went to the Worldwide Developer Conference and I buttonholed everybody I could find about this problem. You know, I talked to the guy in charge of Quartz Imaging. I talked to the head of Developer Relations.
Mm-hmm.
We talked to the Keynote team. We talked to Microsoft, you know, business unit. We talked to everybody.
And what was the response?
Well, you know, the response was, you know, it was varied quite a bit. It was a very, obviously, people had to be made convinced of the seriousness of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't claim all the credit on this because I had one boss and he worked on it and then he went on to some other thing and then my other boss worked on it too. And they worked, you know, very diligently in trying to keep the matter in front of people's eyes. And so we got, you know, Microsoft, it was an agreement that they would preserve the data, you know. If we gave them a PDF with extra data in it, they would preserve it, presumably by not munching the original PDF we give them.
Mm-hmm.
We talked quite a bit with the Keynote team, or the iWork team,
mm-hmm.
and I think they're getting better at it. It's really sort of odd that at least as far as I think iWork, what was the last version of iWork? 10?
Oh, no.
8. 9. Keynote itself was working fine. If you gave it a PDF with extra data into it, it would just return you the same PDF. So it had the actual proper behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But Pages, it wouldn't. But funnily, if you pasted from Pages into Keynote and then from Keynote into our program, we would get back our original data.
Right.
So it was preserved. It just wasn't being put on the clipboard by Pages. And so anyway, but it was a lot of effort to
right.
do that. And Apple didn't necessarily get back to me, but I know middle of last year I noticed that in the iOS SDK for iOS 4.0 they had added what I had been asking them to add. They had added a routine that added arbitrary metadata to a PDF, which is all I needed them to do. So going forward in 10.7, people will be able to do that. In the meantime, I spent a fair amount of time munging the PDF to add our own data to PDFs I get back from the OS 10.6 and 10.5. Yeah, but I will be glad to let Apple maintain that code. Yeah.
Okay, so I want to back up. I want to ask you a couple things. One, on iLife, the latest version of iLife, I believe, is iLife 11. I thought you were asking about the prior
version. iWork.
Oh, yes. Oh, you're right. It's iWork 09. Sorry.
Yeah,
that we're talking about. But so you did work out a solution for this that works in the existing iOS 10.6?
No, I was saying that Apple never told me that, you know, by email or whatever, that they were going to add this API.
Right.
But I happened to notice, because I do some iOS programming on the side, that they had added it to the iOS SDK before they added it to the Mac SDK. We don't care if they add it to the iOS SDK. We don't have an iOS product.
Right. No. I was asking about in the current version. So you'd gone to WWDC. I'm backing up on the timeline here because I want to understand the conversation and make sure that I'm following along properly. So you were working with Microsoft. You were working with the keynote team or the iWork team, and there is a way in the existing operating system, you said, through, I think you used the term munging, but like tweaking the PDF where you could kind of force this metadata that you needed into the PDF, existing PDF format that we have in the current APIs?
Okay. Well, you know, PDF is a standard. It's the ISO 32000 standard.
Right.
And if you read the documentation for that standard, which I have, they do have the idea that you can have a metadata element, which is off the root element of the PDF tree structure.
Mm-hmm.
And that is considered to be, by the PDF people, to be how you add originating metadata to a PDF.
Okay.
And so I read that. I said, okay, this is how we're going to do it. And then I had to parse the PDF I'm getting back from Apple's SDK, and I'm manually inserting my data where it should be and making the proper references and updating, you know, the length of items, the length of the various elements in the index of table of the PDF, all sorts of stuff that I don't want to do.
But you're having to do that as a developer. Now, my question is, so you do all that work and you put that stuff in there, and now your customer, you know, does the copy paste from the clipboard and they put it into an iWork document or into a Keynote or into a Word document.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be maintained at that point?
And it will now with the current version of Office and the current version of Keynote.
But that's because they added support for that? Is that?
Well, I think in Keynote's place, it just happened that they were keeping the PDF and they didn't munge it. So it just came back to me. It was a long-term thing that, you know, my superiors had to spend a lot of time, just cooperating with Microsoft, to come up with a solution. And, people at Microsoft are nice people, and they were interested in, you know, problems that their customers have. It was just a matter of like coming to an agreement as to what they could do, what was practical.
Right. And so now it's looking like with this thing that you noticed in the iOS SDK and now coming to the Mac SDK, you're not going to have to do all that extra work on your end to get that metadata into the PDFs. Is that what's going on now?
Yes, that is exactly what's going on. It will be a great relief. And it was sort of like a chicken egg problem. So Microsoft and iWork and whoever else isn't going to put in support for this if nobody's adding data to their PDFs. And very few people would add data to their PDFs because it's really hard to reliably do what you have to do if there's not a standard SDK. So coming with 10.7, apparently, I'm just going by the iOS headers here because, like, obviously, anything I know about 10.7 is under some whatever developer NDK I clicked on. But the iOS 4 headers are not under NDA, right? So I can talk about them.
Right.
And so it says in the iOS 4 headers that beginning in 10.7, there will be this function.
Okay.
And basically what happens is you give this a bit of XML whatever arbitrary XML you like, and it will store it for you. That's basically all it says. And there's a corresponding one that will extract it.
Do you have a sense if Spotlight will support searching that?
All I know is one line, two lines in the header files.
Right.
But what'll happen is it's going to be compressed. Obviously, I guess you could uncompress. ChemDraw's format is we give it what is our XML format, which is called CDXML, and it'll be compressed and inserted into this our PDF clippings. And which is really good because now it's in a standard place. One of the problems with PICT was that PICT was a semi undocumented format, anything you put in it was sort of like you had to reverse engineer it to figure it out. And now going forward, we have a situation with PDF where PDF is an ISO format. This stuff is zip compressed, and it's an XML. So anybody going forward, as far as archiving is concerned, it becomes much more easy to say, oh, somebody can just write a utility to extract it.
Right.
Because it's in a very standard form, in a very well documented form, and we document our CDXML format on our website, so people can read that format too, and anybody that has the opportunity that has an XML format for their data could just say, oh, give me the XML, give me the XML version of our data. I'm going to jam it in this PDF before I put it on the clipboard. So it's going forward, it'll be a better solution than PICT was.
Right.
But this is a transitional time.
It's taken a long time. So because of all this, I have a couple questions. One, with them adding this, is this sort of solve all the problems? Is this all the bits of the puzzle to kind of move forward, or is there more that still kind of needs to be done, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, nothing is ever properly done. I mean, this in a way, this is sort of a hacky thing because, it would be, so like you have to select one image at a time, right? And if you select five images, it'll all get rendered out to a single PDF, which will throw away all the data. So, I mean, presumably, if there was an actually over-engineered solution to this, it'd be like, oh, here's this clipping. It's composed of a group of clippings.
Right.
Run through it and extract what you know.
Right.
I don't think there's any energy to do that right now. I've solved my problem in the sense that we got it to the point where it was pretty much the situation before this all started.
Right.
But it isn't an optimal solution, and I think why does Windows Phone 7 take a year to get copy paste? Because it seems like copy paste is easy, but oftentimes it is not.
Right. Things are a little more complicated, and people need to understand that. This gives you the run, but I mean, we are going to now kind of have the round tripping ability back that a lot of people were familiar with, back in the old days.
Well, if applications that create images start putting their data in them.
Right.
And so people.
But they can do it more easily. They're going to be able to do it more easily, or at least that's the hope in 10.7 and the indication from the iOS SDK.
Yeah, that'd be my guess. And the other issue that's coming up is, I say that people can still use Word 2004, but people can't use Word 2004 in macOS 10.7 because macOS 10.7 has dropped support for PowerPC or emulation.
Right.
And so, when 10.7 comes around, people will literally not be able to buy a new Mac that will allow them to get their old data out of their old Word documents.
All right, you're giving me the perfect transition, because the sort of the thing I wanted to finish up with this and talk to you a little bit about, it kind of moves outside of the technical aspects of this. I know we've been talking a lot about that, but I think this opens up the larger issue, and I've talked about this on my show because I advocate backup a lot, but one of the aspects of backup that we don't talk about is format shifting. We live in a world of technology where technology moves so incredibly rapidly and changes that we run into these format problems, right? PICT format goes away, or who's to say that the MP3s that I have on my computer today are going to be playable 10 years from now on any kind of device or on any kind of system. Or, you know, the underlying core technologies change. We move from PowerPC to Intel. One of the dilemmas I think we have in the Mac community is our Macs last a really long time. And yeah, they run a really long time. I mean, I have old Macs sitting around here. My blue and white G3, I just started using again as because I needed to do some faxing. It was the only machine I had a modem in. So I set it up. And it still runs great, but it runs 10.4. Right. And it's a PowerPC. So it's not going to run everything. But I think we have this format problem, right? How do we keep shifting our formats? And we were talking before that you have a lot of your customers are in the educational, you know, realm, and those people don't upgrade as quickly as maybe a lot of the rest of us, either due to financial reasons or just they have legacy applications that don't get upgraded or don't move as quickly. So just what's your sense of all that? I mean, how do we deal in this age with continuing shifting formats and support and stuff like that?
Well, you know, I think the one of the important things is that you want standardization of formats.
Right.
And, you know, a PIC file embedded in a Word file, a 2004 Word document is about as non, you know, standards body compliant as you can get.
Right.
But an XML document embedded in a PDF is. So, I mean, there's part of that is that you have, you know, published standards for documents and, you know, you try to hold to them. But in this case, I mean, you just have to, you know, realize that, you know, well, you know, I've been watching a lot of these. Have you ever seen these videos on the web recently that are like some sort of timeline of IE 1 through 9 or Microsoft Windows from version 2 all through Windows 7? Have you seen these videos? And or the interesting sort of thing is that, you know, you can still get hardware and run Windows 2 on it, I guess.
Sure.
If you were so inclined, but you can't get any hardware from that you will a new hardware that runs, you know, Mac OS 1,
right?
On it. Because you know, Apple is sort of the belief that you should suffer your pain quickly and get it over with. Yeah, you know, and Microsoft is the belief that we'll hold on with death's grip to compatibility, no matter how much it costs us.
Right.
In terms of the things we could do otherwise.
Right.
And so this is one of the things about being a Mac user is that, you know, even people that have, you know, Intel Macs are going to potentially be left out if they have, you know, not 64-bit Macs, you know, pretty soon. And, you know, the alternative would be to Apple to spend like two or three times the amount of resources they do on OS development just to keep backwards compatibility running.
Right.
And, you know, as a Mac user, I accept that because, you know, I buy a new machine every 2 years. And if machines go obsolete every 8 years, it's okay. I mean,
right.
Otherwise. But what the problem here is, like I'm describing, is that you won't be able to properly read your documents with the hardware you have in a couple of years. And that's because of this. You know, if we're on Windows, you could say, oh, I'll just boot up, you know, oh, I'm on this PC. Let's just run Office from, you know, 1998. It'll run fine. But that's not the case here.
Right.
As somebody who does a fair amount of Windows programming on work, I hate programming on Windows because it is like that.
Right.
Because the APIs are so stuck in the late 1980s that you can't do things like Unicode easily.
Right.
Or something like that.
Yeah.
But it does come at a cost. And it costs somewhat of a cost to the user.
Yeah. Cost of backwards compatibility. You have the same problem. I think it's just something that I think people need to be aware of. So I was glad that you brought this up, and that was one of the reasons why I wanted to get you on to discuss this, you know, not just specifically for the PICT issue, but that there is broader issues of this with other applications. It's not just ChemDraw. A lot of us have these legacy files that we want to go back and open. I get emails from people asking about WordPerfect documents. Mm-hmm. All the time. You know, I'm on OS 10. How do I open up my WordPerfect document? And I do think it's something that we as users now need to start considering that, yes, in 5 to 6 years, you might not have the right equipment to actually open up that file. So if you want to keep a copy of it, maybe you do want to open it up now and save it out as a PDF. So at least you have the text, you know, even if you can't open that insert name of word processing application here document, you get it into a standardized format. And I think you hit the nail on the head, is that we need more of these sort of standardized formats, XML formats. And I think also a lot of people I know, specifically when it comes to text documents, are moving to just writing straight text files more and more, because they at least know that if I have just the plain text, that's likely going to be supported for a very long time, and I'll be able to get back at least my content. I might not have all that pretty formatting I put in Word, you know, in Office 2004, but at least I have the core content.
Well, I would say that you might be better served saving off as RTF.
that too, yeah.
You know, I guess I've been thinking of things I missed when I was talking to you. One other thing, and this is going way back here on this conversation where this should have been inserted. You know, last year, Keynote was still working fine, and Snow Leopard came out, and then all of a sudden, all of our picks that Keynote was handling, Keynote was still handling picks pretty well.
Right.
All of a sudden, all our picks were converted to TIFF when it got pasted in, because the Cocoa framework, which is what Keynote has written in, it changed what happened when you put a PICT on the clipboard. It changed, it converted to a TIFF,
right,
which is a bitmap format. And, you know, it prints lousy, it looks bad. If you put in, you'd variants of PICTs where you did high resolution PICTs,
mm-hmm.
it would just make a really, instead of making a high resolution TIFF, it would just make a really big TIFF. And people would paste it into Keynote, and it would be like, what in the world's going on with this?
Right.
And, of course, you know, and they blame us. You know, it's frustrating that Apple didn't take leadership on this when they could have, way back when. I'm just inserting that because I should have talked about that earlier. But, I don't have a... You know, particular solution for them. Other people that have a lot of 2000 Word documents that are old, they should probably start thinking about long-term conversions of them.
Right. You know, right. And it's not just those document formats, and it's also storage formats too. You know, I know a lot of people who are storing stuff on, you know, external SATA hard drives they're using for archive, or flash, USB flash drives are getting popular. And, you know, how much longer is a USB port going to be with us? We've got new things like USB 3, backwards compatible, but who knows for how long. Apple's said Thunderbolt is their new thing. So these are just all bits of the larger thing that I think that people need to think about for longevity of data.
Yeah, and you know, you spend a lot of time generating that data.
Right.
You know, if you have a Word document, you probably spent you know, hours and hours on each document, and if you don't want to throw it away at all. Sometime or other, it'll come up in Spotlight, and you'll say, "Oh," and that's another thing. What if these documents can't be parsed in Spotlight anymore? Because, you know, going forward, you have so many documents,
right,
that we can only find it by searching. And if I ask, "Oh, what was that document I had that talked about Adam Christensen in it?"
Right, right.
And it's in a format. It's an old format. Like what was that word process you were talking about?
WordPerfect.
Like, WordPerfect. What was WordPerfect? And Spotlight doesn't. Bother to parse WordPerfect documents anymore.
Oh, even AppleWorks. I mean, that's another one I get a lot of questions about. I have some AppleWorks documents that I wrote when I was in college. I want to use those on my Mac. What do I do?
Even if they're not searchable, they might as well not exist.
Right.
I mean, because I have so many documents. I mean, I had to copy my hard drive over the other day, and I had like 4 million documents on my computer, something like that. The only way I can deal with them is through search. And if my word processing document is so old that it isn't parsed by Spotlight, it might as well not exist.
Right. Well, Glenn, I want to thank you for bringing this to my attention via email and sort of talking to us about this for, you know, about 30 minutes here or so.
Yeah.
Anything else to add before we...
I listen to your show, every week when it comes out, and I enjoy it. And thanks for having me on the show. I hope you're successful in making a career out of this.
It's been good so far. Thanks, Glenn. I appreciate your time.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye.
So there you go. You know, a little bit of a history lesson. If you remember that PICT format, that was kind of fun trip down memory lane. And it's good that Apple is now supporting some of that XML feature in PDFs. I hope we do get some of that round tripping back, because that was a nice feature back in the day where you could, you know, put a document into a file and then get that document back out and work with it and go back and forth between the applications. And I guess in some ways I hadn't really noticed that we lost that, but at the same time, I know a lot of people come back to me and say, I have this document, I can't do anything with it, or I used to be able to do this and I can't do that anymore. And this kind of explains the underlying reasons why that happens. So I find that stuff interesting. I hope you do too. That's going to do it for this episode. I know we ran long. I don't think most of you mind, but maybe in the future we can split some of these longer ones up. But you get a double-sized MacCast this week, so enjoy it. And before I get out of here, I do want to thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software as well as get free trials over at circusponies.com. Smile, check out Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label. Great applications. You get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. And Pharonix, makers of Deep Freeze and PowerSafe Mac. Check out their stuff as well as get free trials and additional information over at pharonix.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Big thanks to you. If you have any feedback, any emails, audio comments, anything you want to mention to me or respond to about this show, any other show, you can send your email to maccast@gmail.com. Or call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. Leave your voicemail messages there. If you'd like to leave a voicemail on Skype, I also have that available. My Skype address is TheMacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the MacCast website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum, forum.maccast.com. And if you are on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or facebook.com/TheMacCast. And I'm trying to post more stuff up to the Facebook page, mainly interesting articles and things that I find that I think are funny or interesting related to Mac and Apple products. So I try not to spam a lot of stuff there. I know people tend to do that. I try to keep it concise and on topic. So if you check out the MacCast Facebook page, hopefully that's what you find there. And please leave your comments and suggestions as well. So I got some new music for you this week. Of course, it is March, and that means St. Patrick's Day. I'm a little bit late on this one. I tend to try and want to play some Irish music right before St. Patrick's Day. We're a few days late here, but I think you'll give me some leeway. I think you're going to like this track. It's kind of become a tradition to play some music from this band every year on the MacCast. So you've heard them before. If you watched Jimmy Kimmel Live, you might have caught them on St. Patrick's Day. They played on Jimmy Kimmel's show. And if you do like the track, I will have a link to the band's website up in the show notes at maccast.com. You can also buy the album on iTunes. So I'll have a link to that there as well. So this is off the album Saints and Sinners. It's called How Are You Girls by Young Dubliners. Enjoy. And I will see you all next time.
A big man, big smile, half an education. Now he's out the door. A belly full of porter, it all has always room for more. Well, it's Friday night, all the boys are waiting to wanna miss around. But before too long, yeah, before it's over, he'll have a point in every town. Tonight it feels a million miles from what he likes.
saw him walking in, that dirty big grin. He hardly set a heart on fire. But before too long, baby, dancing horizontal, you know God loves a trier. Tonight, if